Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Barbecue. I'm Phil Carroll.
I'm Kevin Hornsby.
And Charles Archer. Is it a barbecue, Phil?
It's,
I mean, it's awesome.
I would say we have had the hottest summer, or it's probably the hottest year on record, and then September has come and is probably going to be the wettest September on record. So I don't think barbecues are really going to be coming out. Maybe an indoor barbecue? Anyone? No, that's probably not a good idea, actually, indoor barbecues. But how's everyone doing? A little bit of a summer break in the last couple of weeks. Kev, how's things out there?
Yeah, well, it's sunny every day, so that's not really much difference. Starting to cool down a bit now. We've hit like 30, 31 instead of 33, 34, so all good.
God, I could get the world's tiniest violin and start playing it for you, Kev. Yeah. We're only on 31 degrees.
And I'm going to have to dig my coat out shortly because I'm coming to the UK in a couple of weeks' time. So we'll see.
I wonder, does it feel, if you go from like a hot country and you're living there all the time, where you come to the UK, does it feel a lot colder to you than it does to us?
Yes.
He's walking around in London normally at 20 degrees with a big jacket on and a woolly hat normally. That's usually his attire when he comes to London.
He walked into like the mining conference. Who's this homeless guy? What's he doing? No, it's me. It's Kev.
Yeah. Back again. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, other than that, how have the markets been? I mean, the main thing is we've seen quite a lot of, I know Charles has talked, I've been listening to a lot of podcasts, Kev's done a few, and I've noticed that there's been a big talk of a lot of CEOs who are, you know, really, really working hard over summer. Normally, it's sort of, the city seems to close down. We've seen a lot of raises, a lot of placings, you know, there's been a lot of activity on the markets. How do we feel about the markets right now in summer?
I think, I probably speak for all of us. August is meant to be a quiet month. It's instead been incredibly busy. I've had, companies, clients approach me for the first time in a long time rather than having to chase them down because they want marketing and PR. I'm sure you guys have the same. And you've got brokers, actively calling up companies, offering money without warrants, without huge discounts for the first time in a few years as well. And it's all conducive to this environment where, especially in junior resource, there's risk capital is flooding back, right? And it's just really enjoyable to watch it. But it's not just junior resource. If you look at the, obviously we will probably run down a list of the names in mining, but also in pharma. If you look at IMI Pharma, for example, or Solvonis, or a few others who have just gone on decent runs.
Yeah, Hemogenics.
Hemogenics as well. Yeah. And, the thing is, for a lot of investors as well, including me, like I had some Hemogenics shares that are now back in black, having been in the bottom drawer for years and years. So the confidence, the optimism is coming back to the market finally. Fingers crossed.
Maybe that's one for another podcast, is like how many of these stocks that you put in the bottom drawer come back and actually go above that, your original purchase price sort of 5 to 8 to 10 years later? Does it happen often?
Well, it does happen. Maybe not often, because sometimes you just have to accept a spade and an idea hasn't worked out and it's just crap. But when we speak to like some of the most successful people in, the small cap, like Rick Rule, for example, he'll tell you, you've got to be 50, 60, 70% down to sometimes just accept, you've got to accept that if you want to get sort of 7, 8, 9x, 10x returns.
Yeah, the pain threshold and the pain barrier, I think, is he alludes to. All right, well, let's come on to the sort of wider markets later, but let's just have a look at some of the news stories that have dominated, throughout this last week and also through summer. Who's been flexing this week?
Been flexing this week.
Yeah, well, a bit of a flex on the stage. Well, it's Putin. Putin was in Beijing, where he reaffirmed his strong and long-standing personal ties with Xi Jinping, calling him a dear friend and stating that Russia-China relations are at an unprecedentedly high level. He signed deeper energy deals with China and participated in the massive Victory Day military parade alongside Xi and North Korea's Kim Jong-un, a highly symbolic display underscoring a growing tactical alignment and collective pushback against Western influence. So, I mean, what do you think Trump makes of seeing a picture of Putin on one side, Xi Jinping in the middle, Modi as well, the Indian leader as well there next to him, and then Kim Jong-un as well? You've got three of the largest economies in the world together. I mean, what do you think Trump makes of this?
Yeah, I reckon he's probably not best pleased, but he's quite a reasonable man. He doesn't tend to get very upset or blow up about the smallest things, but I do think that the key thing to understand is, in America, Trump says he's America first, right? America first, we're going to put America first, everybody else is second, here's a bunch of tariffs. And when you go to India and you speak to Modi, he's always been very clear. We will trade with anyone. We want to be friends with everyone. We're going to put India first. And if you speak to Xi Jinping and you look at his history, growing up as a very poor boy in the back alleys of, China, he's going to be top of the party. His political future depends on growth. He's going to put China first. If you go to Putin, he's going to put Russia first. And basically, that's all you need to understand. These three people get together. They just want to improve their own countries. Now, obviously, on different levels, they're all awful people. But actually, they're just putting their own countries first. They just want trade relationships. Having said that, I'm pretty confident if Russia gets weak enough, China has looked at that Russian territory for a long time in their backyard. They want to nick it. India and China are constantly, at each other's throats for, political and economic strength. So actually,
Actually, they share something in common, all those countries. You've got the Russia-Ukraine thing, you've got China, Taiwan, you've got India, Pakistan, and then you've got the North Korea, South Korea. And they're the rivalries. They're almost looking at Russia thinking, well, Russia's got away with it in Ukraine. Could China then turn on Taiwan?
Well, I think the difference is with I mean, there's a thousand differences, but with Russia and Ukraine, the value in Ukraine is under the ground or on the ground. It's wheat fields, it's fertile ground, it's iron, it's commodities, right? With Taiwan, it's the foundries, the semiconductor foundries. So in order to invade Taiwan, you'd have to destroy those. But also the other thing is that the entire world relies on those TSMC foundries. So if you were to invade it, then a lot of people get very angry very quickly. But China's made it very clear they intend to take Taiwan back by force if necessary at some point. So that sort of Damocles will eventually fall. And when that does happen, it'll be very interesting to see what happens to the global economy. But given that we have an artificial intelligence-based economy that relies on those foundries creating microchips. But I mean, you only have to look at the history of, China and Taiwan. China is very clear that Taiwan is part of China. It should be part of China. And it's made all the more complex because the US is, basically have strategic ambivalence. Their policy is we won't say whether we would back Taiwan in the war or not. But I think if China were ever to try to take Taiwan, they would 100% defeat Taiwan, but they would cripple their own military forces. So it's never going to be worth it. I guess we'll see though. What are your thoughts?
I'm sure he's not happy. I mean, but there's a much bigger story with Trump over the last period of time, isn't it? I mean, it seems absolutely bizarre what he's done, what he's trying to do. He's trying to bully the Federal Reserve. He's trying to create his own crypto world as well. And at the same time, he's trying to befriend people while sort of sticking a knife in their back as well. So I don't know. It's all a bit weird.
It is a bit weird. All right, well, a little bit closer to home. What about this whole, I mean, Angela Rayner, the first question I've got for you is,
Oh my
how
God.
long is it until she either is pushed or resigns? This is all down to the fact that she's admitted underpaying stamp duty on an £800,000 flat in Hove, inadvertently saving about £40,000 due to receiving incorrect legal advice tied to a trust arrangement for a constituency home. She's referred herself to the independent ethics advisor, Sir Laurie Magnus, and is cooperating with HMRC to settle the owed amount. Starmer has publicly defended her, calling her action transparent, while political opponents accuse her of hypocrisy. So, what do we make of this?
Oh my God. Okay,
I
right.
know
There's
you're
so
looking
many
forward.
things.
I'm
I don't
looking
even
forward
know
to
where
this.
to start. I bought a lettuce yesterday, right? I'll actually give you a first clue.
Oh, I love the Rainer
But
lettuce.
the rain of that, maybe it should be a cucumber. I don't know. She might hang on a bit longer. But she's responsible for housing, right? If the minister responsible for housing doesn't understand stamp duty, right, then maybe she's not qualified to be in the job along with many other cabinet members. Okay? That's the first thing. The second thing is that if you are the deputy prime minister of a country, presumably you can get some correct legal advice, which suggests either she went skimped on the lawyers, like an idiot, or she didn't give them the correct information, or she went to multiple different lawyers until she found one that said, yeah, it'll probably be fine, and then went with that advice. Third thing, the hypocrisy of it, even if it's legal, which is iffy at the moment, but even if what she did was legal and it's found that, the tax is due, so it's not. It's the fact she's called out a gazillion other people on the other side of the bench, the Conservatives, for avoiding tax. And all of them are in the wrong as well, like Jeremy Hunt with his flats and whatever else. But, the hypocrisy of it, saying, oh, you haven't paid your fair share of tax. But then also it's the fact that this budget that's coming up will almost certainly put more taxes on homeowners, whether it's a land, land duty or, capital gains on your primary dwelling or whatever. And then it's complaining as well in the past about second homeowners, so, putting up rents for everybody else, but now she, effectively has three homes that she's looking, at the moment. I don't know, I could go on forever and ever and ever and ever, but basically she's political toast. And I think the thing that most annoys me about it, more than anything else, is the fact that she thought she could get away with it, right? This is the key thing. Right, she thought that people wouldn't notice and it would just be fine. And she did exactly the same thing when she bought her, her council house, which she said was hers. But actually, is a very iffy statements about that as well.
Yeah, do you
So,
think this is going to come back to bite you already?
she's toast. She's
For
toast.
this
And
cabinet,
there's only one rule for this cabinet, and that is that there's one rule for them and one rule for all of us.
so, do you think that's going to come back to bite her at some point?
think she's so screwed. And then the other thing is, so she's also taken like free gifts. I think it was like concert tickets as well.
Yes.
And then declared those and that, with the free clothes and all that nonsense at the start of the parliament. Basically, I'll tell you what it is, right? Is obviously, I was speaking to a friend literally yesterday about it, is that the Labour Party positions themselves as this kind of like moral paragon of doing the right thing and being on the side of the working person. And every 5 minutes, somebody else senior in the Labour Party does something that makes you think, oh no, they're all the same. They're just as bad as each other. Apart from the difference is we've now got this massive tax burden and tax rises coming again. And the bigger issue, the thing is that these kind of scandals just take away from the bigger problems, which is the fact that, our bond yield, our long-term bond yield is the highest it's been since the late 1990s, higher than the global financial crisis, higher than the Liz Truss letters incident. We
Yes.
literally cannot borrow money at this rate without going into financial implosion. And
Yeah.
so, for example, to balance the budget, we need to cut around 100, 150 billion pounds of spending. We tried to cut 5 billion pounds off the benefits bill, and it got stopped by Labour bank benches. So we
Sure.
can't cut spending at all. We can't increase the taxes because last time we increased taxes, it reduced productivity and our tax take actually got lower. And now
Yeah.
we're going to try and put taxes up again in November.
But they always do the fact that they've got the cap and that, you know what I mean? Like it's a stealth tax every year, the income
Oh,
tax.
yeah, that as well. Well,
So I just want to ask you just a little bit about what you just touched on there. The autumn budget, the fact that Starmer has now turned to Rachel Reeves and turned around to her and said, I'm going to run this effectively. This is mine. He's almost taking it away from her. What do you make of that news?
Well, I think the problem is that it doesn't matter anymore. It doesn't matter who's in charge. It doesn't matter what tie you're wearing. The answer is, right, this is the key problem you have is that we are borrowing significantly more than is sustainable, right? And so whenever you want to borrow money from somebody while you're already spending too much, they're going to charge a higher rate of interest. That's just the way the markets work. That's why our bond rate is so high. So you have this situation where we're borrowing too much, and what we do borrow is really expensive. And the only way you can get out of that doom loop is economic growth, right? You need to grow the economy and then you can take more tax in. But the only way to make that happen, right, is tax cuts. And the only way to fund tax cuts is, because you can't borrow, is spending cuts. And politically, we can't get spending cuts through. So I don't particularly care that Keir Starmer is taking it away from Rachel Reeves. And, Rachel Reeves, in fact, she lied on the CV, it was completely incompetent. It's neither here nor there. It's just a mathematical problem. Like, if you put us three in charge, it would be exactly the same. You need to cut around 8-9% of government spending. And we struggle to cut even a fraction of a percentage politically. And so you've got these comparisons to the 1970s where eventually the IMF got called in. But now you've got the International Monetary Fund might have to come bail out France at the same time while the US deficit is going into crisis mode. And this is why, for example, gold is at record highs. Because, in the US, you've got the same issue. The bond yields are spiking while they're trying to cut interest rates while they're going into a recession. France is screwed. We're screwed. Japan, that carry trade is unwinding. Their bond yield at 3.3% is the highest in recorded history because Japan's not buying that, American debt anymore. And so you have the situation where the bond markets could implode. And this basically, I know it sounds like a massive doom loop, but basically that's what it is. Because the only answer is to cut significant amounts of spending. And it seems politically it's impossible. It seems impossible because, and I think I'll tell you what it is. I realize what it is that we now have millions and we have more people taking out of the system financially than putting in across the Western world. And when you live in a democracy, people are going to vote for policies that benefit them financially. So you can never get out of that system. And then eventually it implodes and pretty much we're a couple of years away from that and then it just will.
Yeah, I think.
Okay, let's end the podcast on that note then. I think.
Buy gold, buy some gold, you'll be fine. That's my takeaway generally, has been for the past few years.
The reality of the situation is that the West has been overspending for decades on many, many different things, and it can't survive as it is. You said it will implode. There will come a point where I hope sensible people will take over and say, no, we have to cut all of this, and that has to be painful. But not has to be painful, it will be painful. You know, and so even things like, and I'm going to sound like Mr. Miserable here, but the triple lock security on the pensions is bizarre. It's absolutely ridiculous. With an aging population, it's costing us an absolute fortune. Less and less workers. And I know what the pensioners are all saying. They're going, oh, but I paid my national insurance. But you didn't. You paid your national insurance for the people who were retired at that time, because that's the way the system worked. There was never a fund that you put in that you receive your money in the pension. But yeah, it's politically extremely difficult to change anything, but everything needs to change. Even going to things like the number of cars issued in the UK, some like 40% of them are effectively benefit cars.
Yeah, motability. More than that, it's about 50% motability.
And it's crazy because people go, oh, well, we pay for them out of our benefits, so we're paying for them. It's like, no, you're not. You're paying for it from taxpayer money. And that's not to say, for example, there are definitely individuals for whom they definitely benefit and we should. But that proportion is insane.
A massive amount that are abused, the system's abused, and then they're actually starting to look into it.
Well, I think, okay, like, I know plenty of people earning 40, 50 grand a year in this country who have never and possibly will never own a new car.
Yeah.
You know, earning way more than the national average because they can't justify the expense. So they, if they can't get a new car, if their car is always 3, 4, 5 years old, then why should anybody who hasn't paid for it out of their own money get a new one? It's mental. Yeah. I mean, the state pension thing is, you know, like my, it's really not complex. Like when it was invented in the UK, I mean, it started in the, you know, just before World War One, but really in modern times in 1948, national insurance funded state pension. Pensionable age for men was 65, right? And the average age of death was 67.
They had what, 2 years of drawing
the
pension? 2 years
on average. Yeah. But so now the average age of death for men is like 77, 78. So if the pension age was 75, which it's creeping up to, it's just coming back to historical norms. And your other problem is that when they introduced it, you had 8 workers for every pensioners. Now you have 2.5 workers for every pensioner. And I think, I mean, like I know I sound, you know, probably, I'll probably sound very different when I'm older. So, you know, I accept that. But we have a country where people can't afford housing. People are struggling to afford food. People can't afford electricity, water, gas. Not people in our tax bracket, like, you know, the average person can't afford it. So people aren't having children because they can't afford to have them, or they're choosing not to have them based on their expectations of a modern world, right? All of the money, you know, a giant proportion of it is going on elderly care, you know, including state pensions of all older people. And so people aren't having children. So the system is becoming completely unsustainable. And the only way to sustain it is with immigration. But the problem with immigration is that when you have too much of it, it's you know, it might improve the economy, but over the longer term, it changes the demographic makeup of the UK too quickly, and it creates tensions.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Use what immigration you get either. That's half the problem, even though people think they can, they can't. But as you said, what we've seen in move, let's move away from people want to slit their wrists and move more towards...
Look at some of the markets, yeah. I mean,
what's been happening with gold, what's been happening with silver. Obviously, we know the reasons maybe why those things have been happening, but certainly seen a breakout in silver. Gold has been motoring now, $3,600 an ounce. Silver hit $42 an ounce, I think, there. So, I mean, do we see that that's going to keep going?
I don't. The problem with gold, so silver, I think, will keep going just because that gap between the, you know, the ratio between gold and silver is still so high that you'll have, you know, as gold goes high, you'll have people like me, for example. I cashed in some gold to buy silver last week because I just decided, you know, if the upside on silver is potentially more explosive now. But basically, if you continue to print more and more fiat currency because you're not prepared to control the spending, then there's going to be more dollars, more euros, more pounds, more yen chasing the same gold. So the gold isn't rising in value. It's just there's more and more fiat currency being printed. So yeah, I think it will continue to go up and up. Having said that, if slash when there is a crash, the things that get liquidated first are things that are easily liquidated. So while people will be going to gold for safety still, you might find there's selling pressure in gold because people who are sitting on a big stockpile of gold go, crap, I need to pay my mortgage, for example, or I need to pay my business debt or whatever else. What do I have that's liquid that hasn't crashed? It's gold.
I think that would be short term, though, to be honest, because
We'll see. We'll see. We'll see.
the fundamentals of the buying of gold are more central banks and more a philosophy in certainly India, China, that it's bought as jewelry as well as store of wealth. But even the jewelry is a store of wealth. So yeah, I think there are many themes going on there. And then you've also got then this whole crypto world. We have basically just gone through 3 months of crypto world, which basically, which I viewed as, and I'm talking about the UK specifically here, where we've had Bitcoin treasuries, we're now having Ethereum plays, we're having, but mainly the Bitcoin treasury plays. How and why do you think we had a effectively moon and now we're back to reality?
Well, I think with regards to the treasuries, and I have to be careful what I say here, but with regards to the treasuries, I'll comment, this is not an official comment for any other clients I may or may not have. With regards to the treasuries, we had this rule in place from 2021 put in place by the FCA to protect retail investors, which basically prevented you from holding crypto ETNs within a SIP or an ISA, or basically in general. And so it's virtually impossible to hold Bitcoin, for example, directly or indirectly within a tax shelter. So the smarter web company comes along and says, we'll buy Bitcoin on your behalf, and then you can buy shares in our company and therefore get exposure to Bitcoin in a tax advantage account, and then take advantage of the flywheel as it shoots up. It's come back down a lot, obviously. But basically, that was the message. So people could effectively buy Bitcoin in their SIP or ISA for the first time ever. The FCA since then has now, they're retracting those rules. So you're able to buy crypto ETNs. I think it's from the 8th of October. And so the demand will come down a bit. But basically, it's been the same in every country where crypto treasuries have come into play. Loads and loads of companies start up, and then there's one or two winners, and the rest of them kind of just fail. And then there's a lot of companies for whom Bitcoin, crypto treasury isn't their main policy, their main, business asset. It's just they hold some Bitcoin on their balance sheet in much the same way as other companies might hold different, currencies. But I think with the cryptocurrency thing in the UK, it's probably going to get hotter and hotter. Particularly where it references to, junior resource. I mean, you probably saw that come from Power Metal this morning. You're going to see more and more of it. I mean, there's others that have got involved, but basically, where you can get the intersection of cryptocurrency, its benefits, and junior resource, that's where it's going to get very exciting. And for example, one project that I'm aware of is a blockchain, as I'm aware of, that we're working on, is where you will have shares of junior resource companies that listed on AIM, for example, and they'll be put on the blockchain. And what that means is that even when the market is closed, you'll be able to trade those. Basically, the shares will be attached to blocks within the blockchain, and you'll be able to trade those blocks between yourself as cryptocurrency when the market is closed. So you can create a
Yeah.
24/7 secondary market.
Bananas, when do we sleep?
You don't. That's the answer. But it could.
This whole tokenizing of assets, I mean, the power has obviously come out with the thing that today, I think First Class Metals also during the summer came out with the thing with
Was Valerian, was it?
with Valerium that they were going to investigate tokenizing an asset to raise funds to then develop it. I mean, it makes sense, doesn't it? It's something that is totally fungible, if you like. You can trade it at any time. It's almost not like cash, but it is similar. So I can see that it will work. I mean, that Power Metal one is it's not really out of the blue when you think about the smarter web company effectively came from Power Metals because it was going to be the uranium thing and then didn't happen. So yeah. All very interesting. And I still think in the longer run, you've got to back companies that have got an underlying revenue stream. I still think Priority One will come good because it's got an underlying revenue stream from all of its businesses,
Well,
and then it holds crypto.
If you look at strategies and MicroStrategy, even them, which is, the poster child, say, for Bitcoin treasury companies, I don't know anyone could argue that they have a underlying business. They have a $100 billion market cap, whatever it is, but their underlying business generates 500 million in revenue a year, so 0.5% of their market cap, which basically means, basically what it is you need to have a situation where you don't sell your Bitcoin, right? And the only way to do that is to ensure you have a business underlying that can keep the lights on when Bitcoin goes through a winter, right? And isn't doing well, because you don't want to sell them when, because Because basically, the problem is if you're a pure play Bitcoin treasury company and you don't have an underlying business, what happens is Bitcoin goes through a dip, or winter, say, we'll say a 12-month period where it's just falling and falling and falling because it's very volatile, even though it keeps going, it's the best performing asset of the past decade, and yet it's extremely volatile. So if you don't have an underlying business, what happens is Bitcoin starts falling. You're not able to raise any money to buy more Bitcoin because investors go, well, it's going to keep falling, so why would we give you money now to buy it? And so you then don't have any money to keep the lights on. So you have to sell the Bitcoin that you have to keep the lights on, and then you kill the business model. So you
Yeah, and I
have to
think
have a
that's one of the
way.
reasons why a lot of them have kept some cash here now. I still, if you're looking at the mNAV and the amount of assets they've got under management, you've probably got to look at the bottom of that now and say who's got the lowest mNAV if you're interested in holding Bitcoin in terms of that. And it looks like Coincilium is the one that has the lowest mNAV at the minute.
Well,
And they're in a situation also where they've got this involvement with Yellow, which I think could be quite prospective, but yeah, it's horses.
I think, without speaking about specific companies, I think another thing to be aware of is that, if Bitcoin just keeps going up and up and up, and now we're at the institutional point where a winter doesn't happen again, as some analysts think, that's fine. If it does have another crash, it's worth bearing in mind that the treasury companies through the equity are leveraged to Bitcoin. So if Bitcoin goes down massively, the treasuries, a lot of them will go below an mNAV of one, basically meaning they'll be valued at less than the Bitcoin they have on their balance sheet, right? Sometimes significantly less. So if you're looking at a medium term trade over sort of 3 to 5 years, if there is a crypto winter, yes, buy the Bitcoin. But also, again, not advice, but yes, buy the Bitcoin, but also actually the upside on the treasury companies will be even starker because they're leveraged as long as they can keep the lights on and don't sell any of that Bitcoin in the first place. When it does recover, they'll recover faster.
Okay, so let's have a look at some of the markets then, and so other movers. We've had the best mover for the sort of 30 trading days, which is pretty much roughly when we recorded the last roast, was Wishbone Gold. And I know you've mentioned that one in the past, Charles. A bit of news coming in on that one regarding the red setter breccia pipe intersected and the extra drilling as expanding that interval. What do you make of those moves on Wishbone, Charles?
Well, I think, I stayed out of it. I stayed completely out of it. And obviously, the problem is that when those move, when it did more than 20 bags at one point, right? And it's still obviously done extremely well so far. And the problem is that, to my mind, I didn't know enough about it. And I've learned from long experience, if you jump into something simply because it's going up, you'll get burnt a lot more often than you make a profit. Now, that breccia pipe is obviously huge news. And no one can argue with it. The assays, I believe they're at ALS now. When those assays come back, if they're strong, then you're going to see an explosive move upwards, and it's going to be very exciting. But if they're weak or they're not good, then that stock will probably go back to where it was before. It may be a little bit higher because of the pipe, but the problem is my perspective is the market is pricing in those assays being exceptionally good when they may not be. And I'm not making any comment on
No,
they will be
I
or
get
not.
that.
We
I
just
get
don't
that.
know.
Yeah, no, we don't know. And I think we've seen quite a lot of this sort of these Western Australian, Pilbara miners do quite well of late. We've talked about Artemis in the past, and we also saw Cloudbake Discovery announce that they got an option. They're in the same region, that an option to a gold copper project in Western Australia, about 40 kilometers away from the Greatlands Telfer project. So we're seeing an upward swing in a lot of these.
Well,
These
it's not just them, is it? I mean, obviously, we spoke to Tristan on the FTR IPO, and that's done well since the IPO. But then also Geo Exploration, Callum Baxter, who found Javier on, he's having another go, and that they I think they've just started drilling. What it is that the appetite for not just for Greatland Resources, formerly gold, but all of the tenure around them, is hugely strong because. Especially in London, because there's quite a few Australian plays out there on the ASX. But if you want exposure to it in London, there's only sort of five or six companies out there, and we've just named them all. And basically, what's going to happen, in my mind anyway, is so Greatland needs the next 3, maybe 4 quarters of gold pricing at this level, and then they'll be able to develop Havieron without any debt. And then they need 1 or 2 more quarters, perhaps, of to get cash in the bank, so they don't have to worry about cash ever. If gold keeps rising, fantastic. But they just need another sort of year and a half. Thereafter, they're going to want to consolidate that region. So if you find anything that looks reasonable, all you have to do is just keep exploring it a little bit or just sit on your hands, and in a couple of years, Sean's going to come out and want to buy it from you. He won't want to spend the money now because having it on his priority. But once you've got to that point, Telfer, that mill, is going to be all hungry in a few years.
Sure. There's
Yeah.
a couple that haven't been sort of pulled up on the radar that I saw. And one of them was, I think, was Gunsind, who've got some, projects down there. And I think the other one was Oracle. Is it? There used to be Oracle Power. I think they've got some projects down there. A very small caps on those at the moment. I don't know what your
Yeah.
thoughts are on those.
Well, I think the thing is when they're sort of tiny microcaps, generally the reason why is they don't have any money. And so, they need to raise capital. But I mean, my only thoughts would be that in this environment where you're seeing stocks down there sort of double in a day and then do that again and again, those microcaps, will they be able, for example, to convince somebody already drilling out there to come over and do a couple of holes?
Yeah.
Will you get an RNS out of the blue to say, yeah, we found someone, we've got three targets, we're going to go drill them?
Exactly.
So yeah, I mean, potential explosive upside, but risk of dilution, basically.
Yeah. Well, Kev, I want to come to you on Conroy Gold. They've had a good swing in the share price over the last few sessions, probably up over 100%. I don't know the exact figure, but certainly around the 8p mark. What do you make of that? Obviously, there was an agreement entered into to restructure the liabilities into the success-linked instruments. What do we make of that news?
Yeah, they've basically just cleared the decks, haven't they? They've cleared the decks of any debt that's in the company, in the topco, if you like, and it puts them in a very strong position now. That money will only be paid at 30p, I think, in terms of valuation. A small net smelter, I think, is applicable. Like, there's gold in them, there hills. It's as simple as that. They need a JV. There isn't another issue. They need a JV. If there's a JV, it'll be 50p. And it won't be 8p or whatever it is now. It will be 50p. Yeah, it's as simple as that. It's not rocket science. I'm quite sure at this level of gold price, it's going to be very, very, very viable and very, very profitable.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's one of those things. It
Yeah.
could happen, should happen. It's the same situation. Or it's not the same situation, but the same situation moving on to another one that I want to talk about is Pazzant Resources. They had the news this summer as well, basically saying we've got a plant and we're moving forward. I've spoken to Colin various times, both on the podcast and also privately. He's progressing this. It's gonna be a producer. It's gonna produce. And based on your figures, Charles, when you did it, what sort of cash flows were you talking about? I mean, even if you gave away 30, 40% of those, because there's going to be some finance or funding coming in now.
I think free cash flow, I mean, when I first did it, it was sort of 30-ish million a year. I think it's closer to 60, 65 now. But obviously you'd have to share that with some of that with a partner.
Yeah.
But
So let's say 40% of that
let's
is.
okay, well let's put it another way. Let's say we actually spoke to Colin about this. I think it would be well south of $20 million to get up
Yeah.
and running, right? So basically you would pay back the cost of the plant within a couple of months. I don't, maybe a quarter. We've got obviously.
Well, not anymore, because that plant's spread over 5 years now.
Well,
So
obviously, but forget all of that, like there is some risk obviously, as there is with everything, but it's a simple operation. Basically what it is, right, is that these projects have just not revalued to where gold slash copper is. And one of the key parts of it is that if you're trying to develop like a large mine, right, then it takes a decade sometimes to get these mines up and running. But if you're doing a simple, just above artisanal mining, which is basically what this is,
yeah,
then you
open
can
pit.
get, yeah, literally open pit, dig it out, process it, and then ship it out to somebody else, basically is what you're doing, right? Then you can be up and running within, 6 to 9 months once you've got finance. So, basically, if the finance was RNS came out tomorrow, say, then you could have the plant, everything up and running, ready to go within 9 months, pay back all the debt of, creating it a month, 3 months later, and then the sky's the limit. You can send out a dividend. You can, develop more of a plant to make it more, to optimize it further, and you can go drill out, what is it, like 70 kilometers, something
Yeah,
along those lines.
initially there's 17 kilometers and then there's another 70 on top of that. But the initial 17, and they've already identified and drilled three targets.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, there's been 66,000 meters of drilling on this open Gorobat.
Yeah,
so it's not like they don't know. It's not like they don't know there's another open pit, because there is. You know, they were talking about it in the last RNS that two of them have been put together, and it's probably going to be,
I think it's the second
open pit.
It's just basically, it's just, you know, the financing to me seems, you know, like it's very attractive. Just get the financing sorted, build it and go, and the share price will move much further than we've already done. On a separate note, the African Pioneer and Ongombo.
Yeah.
Ongombo in the same country. It does, you know, the African Pioneer does not have those Blackstone Mineral shares behind them. So, you know, it is less valued, lower for a reason. But its market cap swings between, what, £2 and 3 million? You know, something on those lines. You could sell right now for 4 or 5x that easily.
At least. And the scenario is as well, that, you know, we've got African Pioneer, which has got a joint venture with a major in Zambia. And
right.
You've also got the Botswana licenses as well, which look very good.
And interestingly, I was going to say,
Galileo as well announced that they'd started the Copperbelt, the drilling in the Kalahari as well, and they've moved quite well from the sort of 0.7s up to the 1.1 mark of late. What do we make of the fact that they're starting to do the operations and starting that second hole of programs with hitting the copper mineralization there in Botswana?
Well, I'll tell you what it is. I mean, we've been saying this for a few years now, but I think we had this junior resource bear market, and obviously these are all Collins companies, and he's got some of the best licenses out there, which, you know, with all the majors coming back to African countries now, with basically they're being forced to because they need to find the metal, right? They need new discoveries, they need new big discoveries. And so Collins sitting there having taken all the majors' old work and then improved it, done more drilling, sitting on the best licenses. The majors are all coming back. The financing appetite is coming back. The risk appetite is coming back. And so, to my mind, all of that homework is going to come together. All of them are going to pay off at the same time over the next 1 to 2 years.
Yeah.
And then he's going to retire.
Yeah.
Oh, he's not going to retire, but I know.
Wow.
I think, you even look at Extract as well. Extract's the same with, they've got licenses in Zambia. They've also got the Silver King situation going on. They've still got the money coming in from the gold thing that they sold.
And the Morocco as well.
Now antimony coming from Morocco, which could be, you know, very, very interesting. African Pioneer, Galileo, Extract, I expect, as you said, they will all do extremely well in the next
one. I'll tell you one more thing, and the only other comment I'll have is that when one has that explosive move upwards, not like the 200% or whatever Bazant has done, but, you know, properly explosive move, it'll affect the rest of them, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, if you're a trader listening in and you don't like long-term positions, you know, everyone makes up a market, just be aware of that. That will happen. If Bazant does sort of 10, 20x from here, there's zero chance African Pioneer is not going to get affected by it, for example, or Extract.
Yeah, okay, because of the profit going in. What about GMET then? GMET's obviously announced a grant a while back, and then more importantly announced an extremely interesting investor who has 15% of the company from Power Metals.
Well, their investor is controlled by Stanley Druckenmiller, who is, other than Warren Buffett, you couldn't ask for a better name. You know, he was the boss of US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent for years and years. It's proper institutional capital. And when GMET announced that grant funding, they also did a raise at the same time. Basically, if you look at the DOD announcement for the grant funding, it basically implies that more grant funding will be coming along, but that GMET will need capital to match it, right? Or at least have money in the bank. I reckon now, you know, the share price is taking a little bit of a breather, and we've had, you know, a decent 10 bagger if you bought under that IPO price a couple of years ago, as I did and several others. But it's probably going to go higher now, because the big issue is obviously it's, you know, the reshoring, but it's a fact tungsten price in China is going crazy. There's a massive tungsten complex in Southeast Asia as well that China is trying to wrest control of to get more control over the tungsten price. And basically, all the other, you know, potential ways of reshoring tungsten in the USA, there are a few other companies out there, but they're just well behind. So
as we speak, it's going back into the 80s again, and I think it will go back to 90s and
well, we said a pound, didn't we? We said a pound. We said a pound. You know, and I said to my wife when we first did this, you know, like when it hits a pound, we'll start de-risking. We'll start taking a little bit off the table. And she's going to probably try to hold me to that. So we're just going to change the password on the brokering accounts. But I think it's the thing is basically is if it was less urgent, if it was less critical, if reshoring tungsten, if America basically had said, right, we're going to start reshoring tungsten 5-10 years ago when it became obvious to anyone with a brain what was going to happen with China, then GMET wouldn't be in the position it's in. They would have gone out, they would have found other deposits, they would have funded loads, the majors would have dealt with it. But they didn't do that. So now I have a company that put in the groundwork over the past couple of years, securing all the best licenses and doing all the headroom. They're going to benefit the most. So yeah, I think GMAT will keep going up from here. How much further up is anyone's guess?
Okay, so I also want to mention Cobra Resources as well, because they've had a really good run. I mean, back at the end of June, they were sat around the 1.5p and they're sort of currently at 4.4, so there's been a good move up. They've had a really good flow of news. They've had the rare earth ISO system beyond Boland, obviously extended out there. Also an update on the low cost recoveries from the optimized testing. They also completed on the sale of the Wodeena Gold project, and then they obviously received payments for that. And then they also announced towards the end of August that they'd an option to acquire a significant copper gold project in Australia as well. So market really likes that one. Strong news. And Charles, I want to also just talk quickly about some farmers, because as you said at the top there, that there's been a big movement and an explosion in some of the farmers. Hemogenics had a fantastic run up, some sort of 250%. We talked about this CAR T technology for leukemia in adults. And then also we saw Immu Pharma doing explosive movements as well on the announcement of this, the patent for P140. So what do you see of happening in the pharma world moving forward?
Well, I think the big thing is the patent cliff, right? And we don't talk about pharma that much on this podcast. Maybe that'll probably change over the next couple of years. But basically, most of the major pharma companies, they get patents for their major drugs, right? Which last, say, 10, 15, 20, 25 years. Over the next 5 years, there's a cliff edge where those patents expire, and then other companies can just create generic versions of that drug. So they need new drugs to generate the capital. And so basically you have the juniors who are, you know, have been starved of money basically for the past, you know, 4 or 5 years. Finally, the majors are looking at it and going, hang on, we need new treatments. So anything that looks vaguely promising, they're starting to throw money at in a way they haven't done before. With Immu Pharma, that patent, the way that worked, that I think that's going to go on another red hot run. I think we've barely got started with that one. Solvenus is another one. That's another 10 bagger there, I think, if we give it a couple of years.
I think Solvenus should do very well. We interviewed Immu Pharma during the week, actually. So if you want to have a more in-depth one on Immu Pharma, have a listen to that podcast. I think it was going to go out on Thursday.
Yeah, there's one all I want to mention, Charles, and it's one that you put on your latest Substack. You talked about two stocks, but the one that had an interesting RNS on the Thursday morning was Defense Technologies. Alert is the ticker. They unveiled a first classified AI product with the UK MOD at the DSEI of 2025, and also a collaboration with one of the Magnificent Seven to embed their research-driven AI and hyperscale resilience into the Defense Technologies' first product. So the market really liked that. I think it was up some 30% on open or within the first 20 minutes. What do you make of that news, and what do you think we're going to expect to see from this company moving forward?
I genuinely, a few months ago, I called the Smarter Web company before it went explosive. And I know it's come down a little bit now. And I took some profit off that. But, you know, I sold out way before I should have done, potentially. This one is in that same kind of arena, that same kind of space. The only difference is you won't get copycats, because their partnership with Whitespace is already embedded in the MOD. So you can't copy that. And then getting a hyperscaler, this is most likely Microsoft or Google, simply because that's the kind of hyperscaler you need in defense on board. And then the people that you have at this company as well, including the CTO, Andy, who I interviewed a couple of weeks ago, who, you know, founded Microsoft Ventures, which is basically Microsoft's startup fund. This we're at the ground level now, even after the rise of something I think could be truly spectacular. I think the rise could be exceptional. There's a lot of people who think, oh, you know, they've barely announced anything. They're just getting started. These people are blue chip caliber. You could not ask for a better RNS than today.
Am I right?
3-4 months, it's going to keep going.
A Am I right in thinking this has got a market cap of about £8.5 million at the minute?
No, that's well, I think wrong. It's a bit has higher it been now. Fully diluted? It's about 13, 14 million now.
But okay. it's we're at the ground floor, basically. Like, I you know, compared it for, you know, to Palantir, there is going to be nothing like it. The growth in it is going to be explosive. And I think basically all you have to do, like, if you're kind of uncertain or you're not sure, you think, oh, it's already gone up so much. And to be fair, it might come down a little bit, you know, before it comes back to new highs. You've got, you know, these people that are on the board, they have a lot to lose reputationally. They wouldn't be in this company unless they thought that it was going to do extremely well. Why would you, for example, if you're Andy, you know, with who could go walk into any Mag 7 company and get like a high level C-suite board job, why would you start come on board as the CTO of a little, you know, tiny microcap? The answer is because you think it's going to be big. It's as simple as that.
Sounds good. Well, normal service will be resumed next week with a roast, so obviously more watch out for more CEO interviews. I'm off to Belgium for a weekend of driving. Lots to do. I think we'll say on that note, Charles Archer, thanks very much for joining us, giving us your insights. And yeah, we'll speak to you next week. Have a great weekend all.
Yep. Thank you.
Cheers. Bye.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.